Good morning. Welcome to the Berean class. We are studying the Gospel of John, and we come to the last verses in chapter 7 this morning. Not infrequently, when I've been introduced to people by other friends or in a situation where I meet people that I don't know or don't know me, and I say my name, they say, "Oh, is that Jewish?" And I say, well, I don't always say this, but I'm tempted often to say this. Spiritually, yes. By blood, no. And I say, "Why do you ask?" He said, "Well, the name Abraham sounds Jewish." And I say, "Well, the son in the end makes it Norwegian." When I was a student in Dallas, First Baptist Church in downtown Dallas had an evangelistic outreach to the Jewish community. And they mailed a invite to anyone in Dallas who had a Jewish-sounding name. I got an invite. I went to the crusade. R.W. Criswell was the pastor of First Baptist Church. He was a famous Southern Baptist icon. Large church. First Baptist owns a square block of downtown Dallas. You could buy Charlotte with that block.
He wore a white suit and had a booming voice.
That's right. That's right. I can still remember his operatic voice. This banquet was, like most of the things that First Baptist did, very impressive. And what impressed me most was on every table they had a bottle of wine. Now, when you get Baptists to serve wine, real wine, in the church, as a part of an evangelistic outreach, you're in the presence of a renaissance in Baptist culture. But the presentation of the gospel was very sensitive. I put myself in the position of a Jewish citizen of Dallas. It's the kind of thing that I wouldn't have found offensive, and I would have found enlightening. It was handled just very well. The point I'm making, however, is this: I was stereotyped, and I want to talk about stereotypes, defiling and or profiling and discrimination today. Almost always when we think of profiling and discrimination, we think of them in negative terms. Are they always offensive and inappropriate? That's the question. And I think that in our cultural media, they almost always are presented that way. But a distinction needs to be made. Only if they are irrational. And if any of you have been involved in hiring or firing, a lot of what goes into making a good hire, or if you've ever done police work, if you are going to be an effective law enforcement officer, you profile all the time. You discriminate all the time. As a matter of fact, biblically speaking, discrimination is a characteristic of wisdom, being able to discern right and wrong, not with necessarily having only objective criteria, but having a sense based upon experience and a number of criteria to make those decisions. But one of the things that we did when I was a student, a seminary student, is that I've told this story before. In one of our classes, they asked us to link up with the Dallas Police Department and ride on patrol with one of the officers. Each student basically was assigned to an officer, and we went on his beat with him. We'd check in at 8 o'clock in the evening, go through their briefings, pair up with our officer, got in the squad car with him, and we spent the night doing what he did, watching what he did. Very, very interesting. I'll never forget the experience. We actually came in response to the holdup of a filling station. We were involved in chasing someone with a helicopter. It was really kind of exciting. But the thing that I remember most significantly, apart from the fact that there was a shooting just a few apartments down from where I was living, I didn't even know these places existed, went into the place and it's all shot up. It was pretty, I guess, Dallas. The thing that I remember specifically, in addition to those things that I just mentioned, was the fact that we'd be driving down the street. Everything was dark, middle of the night, no traffic. And whenever we'd come to an intersection, the patrolman would slow down, he'd look both ways. I thought he was looking for traffic. He wasn't looking for traffic. There was no traffic. He was looking for something that shouldn't be there. And we came to this one intersection, we were talking, and he was looking. And he, without interruption, just basically quick turned the car and went down the street. I said, what happened? And he said, I saw someone down here who shouldn't be here. Now, it wasn't necessarily a black person or a Hispanic person or a white person. It was someone that hour of the night was unusual, and he wanted to check it out. That's profiling. That's basically taking our experience and instincts and applying them to the way in which we give attention to something, positively or negatively. Now, oftentimes when it's linked to things that are irrational, it is dangerous and damaging. For example, Islamic extremists. Does that offend you? Most of us are saying that's not offensive to us. How about Christian extremists, like the Ku Klux Klan? Does that offend you? It offends me. Don't identify the Klan with Christianity, even though the Klan claims to be Christian. But I'm offended that non-Christians would identify me with the Klan or with their religion, with my religion. Somehow that doesn't bother us with Islamic extremism, at least for many of us. But the point is this. Just as all Christians don't equal the Ku Klux Klan or Westboro Baptist Church, so it is also true that all Muslims aren't ISIS. Now, I don't want to get into the political debate. If you're listening to the Republican candidates especially, you're hearing lots of talk about our president refusing to identify the extremists with Islam. There's a reason for that, and that reason is often not very expressed because it can't be expressed without ruining the effect. And that is the fact that the recruiters of ISIS would love to have our president say that Islam is part of the problem. And we all really realize that the Islamic faith is a motivation that is used, at least, and probably has an effect upon international terrorism right now. But I think when we look at history, we have to be honest and say, boy, Christianity was used that way too. And in some circles, it's still used that way, although we would not want to be identified with that. The point is, stereotyping is and profiling and discrimination, these are difficult things, complex things. What are ways we can avoid irrational stereotyping of others and being stereotyped by others? That's what we're going to look at today. They say, where in the world is that coming out of John? Well, we finally got to the text. Here it is. The last chapters in the seventh, last words in the seventh chapter of John. This is a passage that almost always is skipped over. You read the first part of John 7, read through this stuff, and get to John 8, which is much more interesting to us. But listen to what's said here. Some of them went to seize him, but no one laid hands on him. Now, Jesus basically had showed up at this Feast of Tabernacles. He had proclaimed himself to be a Son of Man, messianic figure, and the religious leaders basically knew he was coming. They weren't shocked by what he said, but now they were determined to arrest him and kill him. The officers, who in verse 32 were sent by the Jewish leaders, therefore came to the chief priests and Pharisees, and they said to them, why did you not bring him? The officers answered, never did a man speak the way this man speaks. The Pharisees therefore answered them, you have not also been led astray, have you? No one of the rulers of Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But this multitude, which does not know the law, is accursed. In other words, those who follow him basically are under a curse. Nicodemus said to them, he who came to him, that is Jesus, before, being one of them, that is one of this group of Pharisees. Our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it? They answered and said to him, "You are not also from Galilee, are you? Search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee." And everyone went to his home. Now, in this passage, we have a classic example of profiling. How did the Jewish leaders profile Jesus in this text? They made lots of assumptions without ever hearing or investigating or inquiring of Jesus personally. They assumed his guilt and need for arrest. He was obviously someone who was coloring outside the lines of the law. They assumed he was corrupting others. They assumed that no credentialed person or credible person believed in him, even though Nicodemus was a Pharisee and basically blows the whistle on them on that. They assumed that his followers were cursed. They assumed that all who disagreed with the Pharisees were wrong. And they assumed that his geographic association was biblical proof of his invalidity as someone who claimed to be Messiah. Bill Bright... That's right. Although his ministry was largely in Galilee, they assume that's where he originated. Bill Bright had this famous quote that back in the 60s when Campus Crusade for Christ was being launched, actually late 50s, early 60s. He said, "People don't reject Christ so much as a distorted characterization of him." And there's a lot of truth in this. There are a lot of people who have basically shunned the gospel, who have never read any of the gospels or read any of the teachings of the New Testament concerning Jesus. But they have an idea of who this man was. But it's an idea that comes from a lot of mixed images. For some, basically, he's ethnically oriented. As a matter of fact, most ethnic groups see Jesus as one of them. Now, but of course, we don't do that. In my Lutheran upbringing, this was the Jesus we had. I mean, he was Scandinavian all the way. But other people do that. Other people don't have this picture hanging in the narthex of their worship centers. For some people, Jesus is a revolutionary, and they read the gospel narratives selectively in terms statements like this: "I came not to bring peace, but a sword." And they say, "Tell me, Jesus is against violence? I mean, it's right there in the scripture. He's overthrowing the government." So forth and so on. The point is, as Emil Durkheim, one of the founders of modern sociology, said, we all tend to create God in our own image and then worship ourselves by worshiping that image. Now, there's unfortunately a lot of truth in that. And unless we see that that's just applied to people outside us, just think for a moment how many of us would be comfortable with the real Jesus. I mean, most people in America, especially conservative people in America, especially people who are politically conservative, think that Jesus Christ would have voted Republican. I mean, he basically had a white picket fence in front of his house, and he was happily married with 2.5 children, and basically supported the American ideal. He was a chaplain of the American dream. I've said that several times, but I keep saying it because we're still not getting it. I'm having a hard time getting it because it's very easy for us in our culture to see Jesus as one of us, a reflection of our culture, of the culture that the subculture we're a part of. And I'm not saying that there aren't aspects of our culture that aren't influenced strongly and properly by our Christian heritage. They are. But the uncritical way in which we basically make God more like us as opposed to seek to become more like him is a challenge that every Christian has got to face. Jesus is commonly stereotyped in these ways. a misunderstood Hebrew prophet or teacher and teacher. A lot of historians who would not argue with the fact that Jesus Christ existed in history, they'd say that the Jesus that we see in the Bible may not be anything close to the real Jesus. We probably are safe in saying only this. He is a misunderstood Hebrew prophet and teacher. And I've said before, any prophet of Israel could not get by with saying many of the things Jesus said. His ethical teaching was consistent with the prophetic teaching of the Old Testament and of the teaching of the prophets of Israel, not just the prophets of Israel, of most world religions. That was not offensive. It was his claims about himself. No prophet would say these things. I am the light of the world. A prophet would never say that. Torah is the light of the world, but not me. And we could go on and on. Much of Jesus' claims in John especially are James that there are claims that would be apostate for a Hebrew prophet. So if we take the New Testament record as having any credibility, it makes this view very, very difficult. Others see the Jesus that is popular in culture today is basically a mythical creation of the early church. And a lot of historical critics would say that Paul invented Jesus, and Paul's compatriots. The early church basically developed the image of Jesus in their image to basically support their agenda, so forth and so on. But again, this becomes very difficult when you take the New Testament letters and Gospels at anything close to face value, because if that was the case, the people who wrote the New Testament, who are part of the same culture, why would they present the leaders, the apostles, as idiots in the Gospels? They do not come as heroes and insight with insight. They come across as people who were basically bumbling idiots, not getting it so often. And even in the New Testament, the apostles' posture is one of great subservience to Christ, as opposed to grandstanding their power and their position. A revolutionary social reformer, that's a popular view of Jesus, especially in Latin America. It is easy, basically, when we are deeply and passionately involved in a political movement to want to recruit Jesus to be our mascot. And in much of America, he's a loving, tolerant Santa Claus. I mean, Jesus is the God of love. That means he tolerates everything. But anything that doesn't make me feel loved is basically not of Jesus. Or the chapel of the American Dream. I think you've heard that someplace before here, too. Our values become basically kingdom values. Big, big problem with uncritically managing that. And for some of us who grew up in the abusive context of the fringes of Christianity and extreme fundamentalism, see Jesus as a demanding moral spoil sport. In other words, everything he asks us to do are the things we don't want to do, and the things he asks us to do are the things we don't want to do, and the things that we like to do, he says, don't do it. The big commandment is boiled down to one thing: stop it. Don't do it. And that's the way a lot of people grew up seeing Christianity. Stereotypes. Now, I think it's important for us to understand that the gospel is going to be and should be offensive to a lot of people. If we try to please everyone, we are going to be disappointed. As someone said, I don't know the secret to success, I know the secret to failure. Try to please everyone. And there's a lot of truth to that. Many of us want to be loved by the world, not just by God. And in doing so, we want to make our God as low an offense as possible, to make him as attractive as possible. Be careful. If we present the gospel and live the gospel, are going to have those who basically are offended by it. We should not be embarrassed by that. But we must be sure that it is the gospel that is the offense and not our distorted stereotypes of it or of the Christian faith. Sometimes it's just our bad breath, culturally, socially, psychologically. Sometimes it's our immaturity. It's the fact that we didn't get it. Or basically, we don't care. There are two passages that I want to look at in regard to this whole matter of stereotyping, prejudice, and discrimination. One comes from the gospel, or the book of Acts, in chapter 17, where we can learn from the way Paul talked about Jesus in a culture of his day in the city of Athens. And then we'll look at Acts chapter 6, where we can learn from the way in which the early church handled conflicts within the church. There are other examples we could use, but these are two examples that I think can be helpful for us. Acts chapter 17, if you can't read the screen, if you have some kind of reading instrument or Bible with you, turn to Acts chapter 17, verse 22. This is a story that's familiar to many of us. But Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you, the God who made the world and all that is in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Neither is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all life and breath and all things. And he made from one every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and their boundaries of the boundaries of their habitation, that they should seek God, and if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own prophets have said. For we also are his offspring," is the quote. "Being then the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God has now proclaiming to men that all everywhere should repent, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, even furnishing proof to all men by raising him from the dead." Now, a number of observations can be made here. By the way, some commentators, I think, have wrongly noted that this is not a positive example of how to relate to the culture. This is an area of embarrassment where Paul basically caved in to the culture. What he should have been doing is saying that we believe in the power of the resurrection of Christ and forsake everything associated with the world. And that Paul here failed in Athens simply because he didn't do that. If he'd have been more of a fundamentalist, he would not have basically said what he says here. I would beg to differ. I would suggest that this, like everything else in the book of Acts, when we see from the hands of the apostles, are recorded as examples of being led by the Spirit and having the Spirit control basically what the apostles said and did. But that's aside. Observations we can make. First, he is familiar with non-Christian culture. He was not afraid. Of course, he grew up as a Pharisee, but even as a Pharisee, apparently before or after he was converted, became seriously interested in the culture in which he lived. He was not afraid of it. He was not unfamiliar with it. A lot of us could go to school with that. And sometimes the only familiarity we have is what we read from people who are also not familiar with it, but basically seem to know a lot about it. I remember talking to a person who had written a very caustic, strong critique of the charismatic Christian movement. And I was talking to his wife. I won't mention his name. He's a well-known author. Most of you would know who it was. And she explained to me that her husband had never known someone who's a part of the charismatic movement. But because his wife was in a Bible study where where a group of charismatic women had basically looked down their nose at her because she was not one of them. He was offended by his wife's being offended and wrote this book, this attack on the charismatic movement. Now, that's the kind of thing that oftentimes we will go to and quote when we have equally been offended or are confused or afraid of something we don't understand. We find people who basically agree with us and then uncritically read their critique as though it is real. One of the things that I'm going to suggest is that for many of us, if we want to avoid stereotyping or being stereotyped, socialize. Meet people who don't fit the stereotype. 2 weeks ago, Cece and I went to Raleigh to visit a contractor who were seeking to do some work on our house. And we looked at his office and went into his office and met him. And he had a lot of Egyptian artifacts displayed there. And I asked him if he was from Egypt. And he said, yes. He grew up in Cairo. And I said, oh, are you Muslim? And he said, yes. And we proceeded after he had made his sales pitch for his firm to talk a lot about what it's like to be a Muslim in Raleigh. And he said, there might be prejudice. I'm paraphrasing him. There might be prejudice here, but he said, I ignore it. I'm making too much money to be concerned about that. But he also said this. He said, I am disturbed by the way the media presents the Islamic community here. He said, most Americans would be shocked to find out that in Egypt, if you are an extremist and you take the life of someone because of a religious motivation, you don't have a trial. You're executed by the government. We never hear that. We assume that basically Islamic countries look the other way because they're afraid of Islam or because they secretly agree. That's the kind of thing that doesn't make the press here. But he said, I don't want to be identified with the extremists in the Muslim faith. In the same way, you don't want to be identified with the Ku Klux Klan. And he mentioned that specifically. And he makes a point. The point is, many of us don't know people who are different than we are. And one of the ways in which we erode and dispel irrational stereotypes is by having those social contacts. He does not condemn, but rather builds on that culture. He said, I see you are worshipers of God. And I've said this several times. I think we can learn a lot from Hollywood and Washington, D.C. about the image of God. And I'm not joking there. I'm saying that what we can learn is this. In Hollywood and Washington, D.C., we see the passions and longings of the human spirit, the image of God within us, being expressed in powerful ways. Sometimes the way in which those longings seek to be met are in the wrong area, but the longings are there. And I wish those same longings existed in the Christian church. Sometimes our longings are dead because we're afraid of our passions and longings, where they might lead. And rather than having those passions and longings lead us to Christ, we often are afraid they're going to lead us to some kind of radical politics or some kind of hedonistic form of entertainment or ideology or philosophy. But then we talk about dead churches. The death starts with the death of our longings. We no longer have a strong desire for Christ's return, except basically just to deliver us from the pain. But are we in touch with the pain? And do we basically let our pain move us toward insight in terms of Jesus' teaching and the teaching of the apostles? He does not condemn the culture. He sees the culture basically as having doorways to something else. He affirms common grounds of authority. Your poets recognize this, he says. He quotes their poets, this unknown God. He appeals to universal needs. There's a hunger there that you have. And he's saying, I am applauding that hunger. I'm applauding your search, even though you don't claim you don't have answers. You know you don't have answers. He relates the gospel to life's longings. And he connects the gospel to all of the dangling hooks, the doors that he sees in the culture. We can learn from that. And when we do that, when we have that kind of contact and that kind of interaction, stereotyping basically takes care of itself. Now, Acts chapter 6. Here's a situation where in the early church, there were crowds of people, both from Greek and Hebrew backgrounds, Jewish backgrounds, coming into the church, making up the church. And many of them had needs. They were basically coming from areas outside of Jerusalem. They were staying because they had been converted to belief in Jesus Christ as the Messiah. And there were material needs in terms of caring for the poor among them. And in the process of the distribution of goods and sharing of goods to meet those needs, there is a sense in which Hebrew people got first place in the line. And the people who from a Hebrew background got preference over those who were not Hebrew. And as we know from the book of Acts, it took quite a while before the Jewish believers really were completely fearless in terms of welcoming Gentiles into the Christian community without first becoming proselytes to Judaism. That was an issue that wasn't solved until chapter 10 of Acts and later. But this is what happens as a result of that dilemma in the church. Now at this time, while the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint arose on the part of Hellenistic Jews, that is the Greek-speaking Jews and Greek cultural Jews, against the native Hebrews, because their widows were being overlooked in the daily serving of food. And the 12 summoned the congregation of the disciples and said, "It is not desirable for us to neglect the word of God in order to serve tables. But select from among you, brethren, 7 men of good reputation, full of the spirit and wisdom, whom you may put in charge of this task. But we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word." And the statement found favor with the whole congregation, and they chose Stephen, a man full of faith and of the Holy Spirit, and Philip, Prochorus, Nicanor, Timon, Parmenas, and Nicholas, a proselyte from Antioch. And these they brought before the apostles, and after praying and laying their hands on them, they were accepted. Now, the significance of this is the fact that these names are all Greek names. The Greek-speaking Jews, the Hellenized Jews, were feeling neglected. How did the apostles handle that? They basically did not send Hebrew background people in to straighten out the problem. They chose people from within the offended community to basically do the work. Ben Witherington, who was a part of this congregation when he was a student and now is a decorated professor of New Testament, had this to say in respect to Acts chapter 6. The apostles handed the whole system over to the offended minority. This may thus be the first recorded instance of what we might call today affirmative action. And what he's saying here is this: the apostles in their wisdom took Greek-speaking Jews to handle a Greek problem in the church. In the same way that a lot of the offense with respect to the law enforcement of minority communities rests upon the presence of white police officers and white administrators, wisdom would suggest that we handle that situation by not exacerbating it in terms of keeping the races distinct, but basically have minority officers patrol and govern minority precincts. That's just one simple explanation. Most of us would or suggested, most of us would probably agree with the common sense of that. That is seen in the New Testament. And the point is this: the the tendency to stereotype, the tendency on both sides of any issue, is a part of human nature, fallen human nature. Don't exacerbate it. When there are conflicts, don't exacerbate the differences. If there's a tension in this church between young families and senior citizens, and the young families are saying, or the senior citizens are saying, basically, they aren't playing our music. When's the last time we heard a hymn in this church? Kind of thing. And I've heard that being said. And I think there's a sense in which it is true, most of us prefer to worship with the music we heard when we boarded the ship. When we became Christians, that's where basically the most meaningful stuff took place. If you were Anglican and became a Christian through the Anglican Church, you would like an Anglican service deep down in your heart, probably. If it was a Baptist church, that's what you want. If it was Fanny Crosby's hymns, that's what you want to hear until the Lord comes back. You don't want those things to change. If you came to Christ and to a meaningful relationship with Christ in a contemporary setting, that's the music you want to hear until basically the ship's docked in terms of your Christian experience. That is human nature. And I'm not saying that one is right or one is wrong. I'm saying those conflicts in the church are inevitable, but they shouldn't become combat. And so they don't become combat. The way they're handled is very important. One of the ways you dispel the stereotype is not by reinforcing it. It's not by basically taking people who are not a part of the offended group and excluding them from solving the problem. You basically put the hands the challenge in the hands of wise people who are a part of the offended group but are able to see beyond the preferences and passions of the offended group and can help the offended group come to be at peace with what's going on, or with at least a reconciled relationship with those with whom we have differences. The point is, this is a part of the way in which the early church teaches us how to handle stereotypes. Another passage is 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And here Paul basically reveals his modus operandi in terms of relating to the culture. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, that I might win the more. To the Jews, I became as a Jew. He didn't say I became Jewish in my faith. He said I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. As those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those who are without the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I may be by all means save some. Now this is a remarkable concession from a former Pharisee. Observations. The Pharisees were doing all they could to separate from worldly culture. Paul was bending over backward to connect with the culture without capitulating to it. The Pharisees were identifying with a subculture they had created while demonizing all outside that culture. Paul was willing to give up his freedom and natural identity to be seen as an image bearer of Christ to his broader culture. That is the model he gives to us in his teaching and in his example in Athens and in the example of the early church in Acts chapter 6. Five ways to curb stereotyping others. It starts with our children. Social friendships with those who are different tend to erode fear and encourage empathy. Stereotypes largely come from fear, the fear of the unknown. Those people they eat different food. They have different ways of expressing themselves. They have different likes and dislikes. We don't understand this. As I've said before, where I grew up in the Midwest, there were two types of people. There were Norwegians and those who should have been Norwegians. Kind of thing. There were those who were like us and that unfortunately weren't like us. All of us have that tendency. We're afraid of things we don't understand. One of the ways, one of the easiest ways in which we dispel that is by, in early life, developing relationships with people that dispel those fears. And you say, we're not going to do that because that'll just reinforce those fears. No, it'll reinforce the prejudices of the parents, not of the children. We found that children make wonderful, wonderful examples of how to see beyond people's skin color and economic status. One of the things that we're proud of with respect to our daughter and her husband's rearing of children, and we're constantly impressed with how they could do so well, having never listened to us. But they are doing quite well, is the fact that they are insisting that their kids be in a pluralistic environment in education. And when they have a birthday party, it's mixed. Of course, we have a mixed race family, Japanese and Chinese. But it's African American and Hispanic as well. When they have a birthday party, it's basically all over the globe. And the kids there, their closest friends are of a different nationality. We went to one of the events at the school, and our daughter, Sasha, was one we were looking for and waiting in line to get into her classroom. And a little African-American girl came up, and she said, "Are you Sasha's mommy and daddy?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, I'm Sasha's second best friend." Now, if you know little girls, it changes from week to week, with that kind of thing. But she was proud to be able to say that. The point is, children don't have the problems their adults do. They acquire those problems largely from their parents and grandparents. Look for the image of God in all people. I have to remind myself of this all the time. When I hear stories of axe murderers and you know, these people who are obviously demonically influenced, I have to recognize that all of that quote-unquote crap, there's the image of God buried deep in there. Suppressed, repressed, but there's the image of God in even these despicable people somewhere. Secondly, imagine the love of God for all people. Imagine the fact that if Christ came back, where would he be? Would he be in Chapel Hill? Probably not. Or if he was in Chapel Hill, probably not in the communities where we live. And it's not that he dislikes us. He just basically would probably be concerned about the people that our culture has forgotten in some way or misplaced. That's where he was in the first century. That's part of the reason he got in trouble. He was a friend with the wrong types of people. And I think that if he came today, we'd probably say the same thing. That couldn't be Jesus. He's hanging out with the wrong kind of people. He's not hanging out with us. We got to be careful of that. Love the people that God loves. Thirdly, socialize. 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 Develop friendships, not just the fact that you know the name of someone. Develop friendships with people from different ethnic and economic stratas and subcultures of the environment where we live. We have close friends who are German, close friends who are Japanese. We have learned in those relationships, we don't talk about World War II. Now, it's not a problem with me, but as one of my friends said, yes, because you won the war. It's a problem if you went through the war and were bombed. It's a problem if your ancestors died, you know, at Hiroshima. Then it's a touchy issue. We don't know that unless we have relationships, close relationships with those folks. Empathize, empathize, empathize. The golden rule can be boiled down to one word, empathy. And some have suggested all of ethics boils down to the golden rule. If that's true, I'm going to suggest all of ethics at its root has empathy. Now, you have to unpack that in some ways, But empathy is very, very important. Commit yourself to being the answer to someone else's prayer. I mean, we are schooled on the importance of prayer with respect to handling problems. Many of us are never challenged to see ourselves as the answer to someone else's prayer in terms of meeting a need, in terms of showing up for someone else. But as Christians, as Christ followers, he is not just encouraging us, if you look at his teaching and the teaching of the apostles following him, he's not just encouraging us to pray to God to basically respond to our needs. He's encouraging us to sacrifice ourselves in answering someone else's prayer, being God's instrument in answering someone else's prayer, serving someone else, helping someone else. A quote that some of you may or may not recognize. I'm a Christian. I am a devout Christian. I believe in the redemptive death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. I believe that faith gives me a path to be cleansed of sin and have eternal life. But most importantly, I believe in the example that Jesus set by feeding the hungry, healing the sick, and always prioritizing the least of those over the powerful. Accepting Jesus Christ in my life has been a powerful guide for my conduct and my values and my ideals. Barack Obama in Christianity Today. Now, I've heard people say Barack Obama is a closet Muslim. Well, they say, well, I'm not impressed with this. He's a liar also. That is something that is hard for many people to swallow and say, boy, talk about stereotyping. Now, again, am I making a political statement about Obama's policies, so forth and so on? No. Am I necessarily a supporter of everything he does? No. And I'd say the same thing for a Republican. Matter of fact, part of the difficulty with stereotyping in the evangelical community is we are stereotyped as being of a particular political party. Boy, is that damaging to us, to our witness. If Jesus Christ came, I can guarantee you he would not be a partisan politically. He would say, basically, you make too much of your politics. That's not where the power really is, although that's where the world thinks it is. If you haven't guessed this, that with what and how I teach, I try to dispel some of the negative evangelical stereotypes in the academic community, like quoting Barack Obama. Many people outside of the Chapel Hill Bible Church have looked at the Chapel Hill Bible Church as an evangelical church. What that means is that it's racist, deep down inside. Oh, it tries to cover it up, but it really is. That it's bipartisan politically, it's right-wing, militantly, activistically right-wing. It is anti-intellectual. It doesn't listen very well to those outside of its own huddle, so forth and so on. If you haven't guessed, I try to basically dispel those stereotypes. And in doing that, I raise lots of suspicions. Uh-huh. Is he liberal or conservative? Is he really a conservative? We don't know. We're confused. Well, we seem to like his teaching, but boy, he says some things where he really is obviously off base. I would admit I'm probably off base on a number of things, like everybody else. We see dimly. But the point is, the thing that I don't want to take place is for the stereotype in the community of the Chapel Hill Bible Church or of other evangelical churches being propagated as Christian distortions. If we're going to have a witness, we're going to basically have to try to clear the deck of a lot of those stereotypes. Four ways, quickly, before we dismiss. Cultivate a healthy self-critical sensitivity. The life that is not examined is not worth living. And there are stereotypes that all of us probably have. We need to examine ourselves and say, do we fulfill a stereotype? Have we adopted a Christianese language, for example, that only those of part of our subculture in Christianity can understand or appreciate? be sure our distinctives are godly. We want to be distinctive. We aren't afraid of being offensive, but be offensive for the right thing. Work to rehabilitate the stereotypes. Be conscious of the stereotypes and basically don't feed them, don't magnify them, the negative stereotypes. Okay, in Matthew chapter 5, I'll close with this. Like Jesus, we are to be salt of the earth and light to the world, but not if we become tasteless and hidden or a toxic distortion. I'm adding that from Galatians chapter 1, verses 6 to 10. Okay.